The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is an empowering hour. Today, a special commentary on The Sky Really Is Falling by Chris Hedges from Truthdig. The latest on the worst carbon emissions leave climate on the brink, and ocean acidification is the latest manifestation of global warming. This will be an education for all those who are still in denial about the impact of human beings upon the environment. Then I'm going to have a commentary from John Pfeffer from the Institute for Policy Studies on Obama the Surrendered Wife. Then we're going to open it up for your calls. I will then talk about the drugging juveniles, doctors hired to evaluate kids in state custody, of which there are millions. Well, they have gross conflicts of interest. They're taking huge payments from drug companies. Palm Beach Post reporter gives a story on that. The latest, of course, on health and healing. This is the place to go if you are really tired of hearing the same left is wrong, right is wrong, attacking each other, coming away feeling like you just watched some blood sport, some cockfighting in Bangkok. This isn't what radio should be. Empowerment is what radio should be, and we are the place for empowerment. Let's begin. Vitamin D, if you're a man wanting to reproduce, and many do, but have found that you're not able to, and you suffer from male infertility, according to the Human Reproduction Peer Review Journal and a major Dutch study, vitamin D has a major role to play in sperm motility. That means the actual movement of the spermatozoa, which is necessary for fertilization. This was done at the Martin Bloomberg Jensen of Copenhagen University Hospital and Associates, and they work with hundreds of men, and they find out that when they're deficient in vitamin D, that impacts the parathyroid hormone and other factors. When they were given adequate vitamin D, it improved sperm motility, which allowed for fertilization. Therefore, one more way for those couples to help improve their chances. Otherwise, you take the fertility drugs and you find out you have 37 babies. Well, you don't need that. One is enough. Thank you. So, vitamin D. Also, good news if you're an older person, meaning over the age of 50, and you suffer from depression. A new study out of Pavia, Italy, quote, recent observations show that long-chain omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids could represent a potential treatment for elderly depression. And then it goes on, in this double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled trial, they found that when they were given 2.5 grams a day, that's not a whole lot, that's a fair amount. I would actually go to 3 grams a day. And in this group of patients, and then gave another group placebo, the group, all of whom were equally depressed, the group that received the omega-3 fatty acids had a substantial reduction in the treatment period, which was 8 weeks, in their depression. In fact, this was equal to the tranquilizers, but no side effects. So using omega-3 fatty acids instead of tranquilizers for elderly patients, I think would be a terrific benefit to them. If you have taken hawthorn, which is good, but beetroot, which is even better, and you try the two together, you can boost your heart health. Now, this is a major study, and here's what it says. Beetroot and hawthorn berry can boost the activity of an enzyme linked to improved heart health. Hawthorn berry and beetroot were chosen for specific reasons. Researchers at the University of Texas report that the herbal blend could improve the status of nitric oxide in the body. Now, I reported a couple weeks ago on this program that nitric oxide is a potent vasodilator. That's really what makes Viagra work. And it also promotes dilation or relaxation of blood vessels, thereby easing blood pressure and boosting heart health. And here's what it says, quote, "The strategy of combining natural products, botanicals, for their nitric oxide activity shows promise in restoring nitric oxide control in human subjects at risk for cardiovascular disease for use as a dietary supplement." And that's what they wrote in Nutrition Research. So a couple other things will do that as well. L-arginine, the amino acid, at about 2,000 milligrams. And then when you use choline at 1,000 milligrams, or phosphatidylcholine, that improves the nerve function that goes from the brain to the reproductive organ, enhancing physical desire. So that way you not only can expand the blood supply that can help your heart, but can also be a natural form of Viagra. Also, they found in a study that was published in the Peninsula College of Medicine, UK, that acupuncture benefited those with unexplained symptoms, where the medical doctors could not find a specific underlying cause of pain, fatigue. Acupuncture did the job. That's good. Now, as we get older, our brains don't function as they should. I've just completed a major project on this. 4 years of research, writing, filming. It's all done. It'll come out in the fall. But I was happy to see this morning from Science Daily that they're now finding, similarly, that this was at Mount Sinai School of Medicine, that why the aging brain is less resilient and less capable of learning from life experiences. Because the findings provide further insight in the cognitive decline associated with aging. And I'm talking about cognitive decline starting in our late 30s and accelerating. And that in turn can lead to neurodegenerative disease like Alzheimer's. According to this article in the Journal of Neuroscience, that the evaluation of the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain that controls a wide range of cognitive processes and mediates the highest levels of learning, nerve cell, the circuitry in the prefrontal cortex is highly plastic, and life experiences, particularly those that involve learning, can profoundly alter prefrontal circulatory makeup. For example, stress causes nerve cells to shrink, and that causes a loss of synapses, the sites of communication between nerve cells in this part of the brain area, and the nerve cells recover once the stress ends. In order to investigate the effects of age on such young, middle-aged, and aged rats in this case, they were subjected to behavioral stress tests known to elicit nerve cell changes in the prefrontal cortex. And that's what they found out. So, here's what it means in lay language. When you're stressed for any reason, you're angry, you're depressed, you're stressed, you actually shrink the nerve cells. That means you do not have the same capacity for learning. On the other hand, I have found ways of stimulating those nerve cells and to increase synaptic activity with various stimulations. For example, relaxation with deep breathing and listening to a soothing sound. A water, for example, a waterfall or a bubbling brook. Listening to breeze through a tree. These are able to create almost a state of consciousness that expands the capacity of the brain to have input. Then take certain nutrients like R-alpha lipoic acid. Very important would also be phosphatidylserine, S-E-R-I-N-E, and L-carnosine, a choline or lecithin, just regular old lecithin, a couple tablespoons of lecithin in a health drink in the morning would be terrific for you. Coconut oil is also good. And a B complex at about 100 milligrams. Then engage in some form of learning that is not distressing, but pleasurable. And when you're learning in a pleasant state, when your mind is relaxed, when you do not feel anger, frustration, you feel at ease, then you lay down new memories and new messages in those neurons. And your whole brain circuitry works to your advantage. So you actually increase your capacity to learn as you get older. So this study shows us why so many people don't learn and end up forgetting a lot, because they're not doing anything to help them. But I have a whole lot of material on this coming in the near future. And starting next week, I'm actually going to do a three-month health support group. My office is closed today, so I don't want anyone calling my office and asking for information, but I'll give it more information when that opens again tomorrow. And finally, simple sugar, lactate, is like candy for cancer cells. Cancer cells accelerate aging, inflammation in the body to drive tumor growth. Now, who's saying this? This is researchers from the Kimball Cancer Center at Jefferson, and they've shed new light on the long-standing conundrum about what makes a tumor grow and how to stop it. Interestingly, quote from Science Daily, cancer cells accelerate the aging by nearby connective tissues to cause inflammation, which ultimately provides fuel for the tumors to grow and even to metastasize. This revealing symbiotic process, which is similar to how muscle and brain cells communicate with the body, could prove useful for developing new drugs to prevent and treat cancer. In this simple model, our bodies provide nourishment for the cancer cells via chronic inflammation. People think that inflammation drives cancer, but they never understand the mechanism. This is according to the professor and chair of stem cell biology and regenerative medicine at Jefferson Medical College of Thomas Jefferson University. In the normal aging, DNA is damaged and the body begins to deteriorate because of oxidative stress. Quote, we are all slowly rusting, like the Tin Man and the Wizard of Oz. And there's a similar process going on in the tumor's local environment. That's according to Dr. Linsanti, who was on the study. Dr. Lassani and his team previously discovered that cancer cells induce this type of stress response in nearby cells to feed themselves and grow. Now, here's the good news in all this. This was published in the journal Cell Cycle. When you take in simple sugars and fructose, you're actually feeding the cancer. When you keep yourself stressed, you're feeding the cancer. When you take in salt, sodium, you're feeding the cancer. So, change the biochemistry. Change the level of oxidative stress. Take in antioxidants throughout the day. Take in a lot of antioxidants like vitamin C and quercetin that can directly impact the growth of that cancer. Take in the antioxidants in Hyorac that protect the cells from oxidative stress. And you're preventing the cancer in the first place, or preventing it from growing if you already have cancer. And all of you in this audience who are taking your antioxidants, taking your fruits and vegetables, Hyorac, you're doing yourself an enormous benefit. And also those of you who have gotten away from the simple sugars, as I most of you would suggest have, you're really on the right track. So now they're understanding the chemistry. By the way, this is material that all of the naturopaths and the homeopaths, the holistic chiropractors, and the holistic nutritionists have known for decades. Feed the cancer with caffeine and with sugar. And that causes chronic inflammation. Turn off the inflammation with an alkalizing diet, high in green vegetables and juices and powders, and you starve the cancer. The more oxygenation of the cell, like higher altitude, the more vulnerable the cancer is, and the healthier you remain, That's why you have less cancer at high altitudes and get rid of all the excess sodium. I'm Gary Knoll, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Distant mama.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to give two issues now for you to call and comment. Any comment you'd like, it's your opportunity. I will save my thoughts. I'd prefer to hear yours. And this is from John Pfeffer, and it is from the Institute for Policy Studies, and here's what it says. It's a short commentary. For some people, there's nothing President Obama can do to prove his love for Israel. He could pull a Sammy Davis Jr. and convert to Judaism. He could give Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu a big kiss on the lips. He could personally expel Palestinians from East Jerusalem. And still, Washington Post columnist Jennifer Rabin would kvetch. In his speech to the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, APAC, last Sunday, President Obama did practically everything he could to prove his love. Quote, because we understand the challenges Israel faces, I and my administration have made the security of Israel a priority. That is why we've increased cooperation between our militaries to unprecedented levels. It's why we're making our most advanced technologies available to our Israeli allies. It's why, despite tough financial times, we've increased military financing to record levels. Unquote. Let me see if I get this straight. We're cutting our budgets here at home in order to send advanced military weaponry to a country that built a secret nuclear program, has continued to expand settlements in Palestinian land in violation of international law and common decency, and under the leadership of an ever-intransigent Netanyahu, has refused to negotiate in good faith a deal with the Palestinian authorities. This is, in other words, a rogue state. We should be suspending military cooperation with this country, not rewarding it, at least until it mends its ways. We should be pushing for a region-wide nuclear free zone, as Foreign Policy in Focus contributor Kevin Martins argues in Zoning Out Nukes in the Middle East, and not treating Israel's nuke status as an immutable fact. Given the resolutely pro-Israeli policies of the current administration, it's no surprise that the APAC audience enthusiastically embraced the president's speech. According to the White House transcript, the audience applauded at least 50 times in a speech that contained only 150 sentences. That qualifies as a love fest. You would think that APAC's seal of approval would be enough, but no, Jennifer Rubin reserved her affection for the real Israeli supporter of APAC, Congressman Steny Hoyer, Democrat of Maryland. Hoyer was the un-Obama, clear, unequivocally supportive of Israel and entirely within the mainstream bipartisan pro-Israeli tradition, unquote. Obama was, contra Rubin, clear and unequivocal, but he did something that Rubin didn't like. He displayed the slightest hint of gumption by challenging not Israel, but Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and the other right-wing yahoos in his administration. In his Middle East speech last week and then again at APAC, Obama said that any deal should involve, quote, 1967 lines with mutually agreed swaps. In other words, any deal to establish a Palestinian state, the two-state solution must turn the clock back before the Six-Day War in 1967, when Israel seized control of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip, among other territories. The swap part is an acknowledgement that Israeli settlers have changed the facts on the ground in the West Bank so that the Palestinians should be compensated with different territory in exchange. Well, this is not a new position. The 1967-plus swap deal was at the heart of Bill Clinton's efforts in 2000. Previous Israeli administrations have accepted this approach. It is an uncontroversial approach among many Israelis. Quote, the new world envisioned by Obama has no place for endless military occupation, for scenes like Operation Cast Lead, for shooting at protesters, and for checkpoints, writes Gideon Levy in Haaretz. Quote, there is no agreement without a Palestinian state, and there is no Palestinian state without the 1967 borders, unquote. Netanyahu, however, believes otherwise. When they appeared together at a press conference at the White House on Friday, the Israeli Prime Minister dismissed Obama's plan for a peace based on illusions. Basically, Netanyahu has been treating the U.S. president like a surrendered wife. According to the surrendered wife doctrine, the wife relinquishes all control and illusions of control over her husband's life. Obama's timidity was the functional equivalent of a wife saying to her husband, "I love you, but could you please take out the garbage once in a while?" Netanyahu, the domineering husband, blows up when he hears "but." Unfortunately, despite Palestinian President Abbas agreeing to such reciprocal territory swaps, even though it would leave the Palestinian state with a bare 22% of Palestine, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has refused to consider trading any land within Israel while simultaneously insisting on annexing large swaths of the occupied Palestinian territory. That's according to senior analyst Stephen Zunes in Obama's Mideast speech. How such mutually agreed upon swaps will take place without the U.S. exerting enormous leverage, such as withholding some of the annual $3 billion in unconditional aid provided annually, which Obama has already ruled out, is hard to imagine. In conclusion, one of the interesting words in Obama's speech was continuous, as in the Palestinian people must have the right to govern themselves and reach their potential in a sovereign and continuous state. Right now, obviously, the West Bank and Gaza are not territorially contiguous. In 2000, Ehud Barak offered Yasser Arafat at Camp David a large portion of the West Bank, all of Gaza, and a strip of the connecting land. The problem was, and still is, that Israel has used walls and checkpoints to divide the West Bank into all manner of non-contiguous areas. At some point, if negotiations actually happen, the U.S. president should clarify that contiguous applies between as well as within the occupied territories. Before that point, of course, Obama has to abandon the surrendered wife role and show a bit more tough love. And that doesn't seem possible. The United States has some real leverage over Israel, but will not use it. And the Arab Spring is altering the political geography of the region. Your thoughts. Our number, 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I've been traveling a great deal, but when I am in the United States and I am in some form of transportation, a car driving someplace, I generally try to listen to the different commentaries from the different networks to see how they're handling world events and things here at home. I'm really surprised that people who claim with very large audiences that they're very right on their facts are so wrong. Sean Hannity, Mark Levin, Bill O'Reilly, a whole list of people who are simply wrong about their positions on global warming. I want to give some updates on this, something that no one's talking about. At least I haven't been able to find it talked about on the internet or on any of the networks or cables. Ocean acidification. Now, this is from Robin McKee, science editor of the Observer in the UK. Quote, "The infernal origins of Volcano Island are easy to pinpoint. Step off the hydrofoil from Sicily, and the rotten egg smell of hydrogen sulfide strikes you immediately. Besides that, there are piles of yellow sulfurous rocks and chunks of pernice. The beach is made thick, black volcanic sand, while the huge caldera that dominates the bay emits a constant stream of smoke and steam. But volcanoes' importance today has nothing to do with the rock and the lava it has spewn out for millennia. It is the volcano's output of invisible carbon dioxide, about 10 tons a day, that now interests scientists. They have found that the gas is bubbling through underground vents and is making the island's coastal waters more and more acidic. The consequences for sea life are grim, with dozens of species having been eliminated. That discovery is highly revealing and worrying because volcanoes' afflictions are being repeated today on a global scale in every ocean on the planet, not from volcanic sources, but from the industrial plants, power stations, cars, and planes that are pumping out growing amounts of carbon dioxide and which are making our seas increasingly acidic. Millions of marine species are now threatened with extinction. Fisheries face eradication, while reefs that protect coastal areas are starting to erode. Ocean acidification is now one of the most worrying threats to the planet. According to marine biologists, quote, just as volcano is pumping carbon dioxide into the waters around it, humanity is pouring more and more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. That's according to Dr. Jason Hull Spencer, marine biologist at Plymouth University. Some of the billions of tons of carbon dioxide we emit each year lingers in the atmosphere and causes it to heat up, driving global warming. But 30%, I repeat, 30% of that gas is absorbed by the oceans, where it turns to carbonic acid. It is beginning to kill off coral reefs and shellfish beds and threatening stocks of fish. Very little can live in water that gets too acidic. Hence, science's renewed interest in volcano. The carbon dioxide springs, which bubble up like burst water mains below the shallow seabed, providing researchers at the Natural Laboratory for testing the global impact of ocean acidification. Quote, these vents and the carbonic acid they generate tell us a great deal about how carbon dioxide is going to affect the oceans and marine life this century. And we should be worried. This problem is a train coming straight at us. Unquote. That's from the lead scientist. Oceans absorb millions of tons of carbon dioxide every hour, and our seas are 30% more acidic than they were just 100 years ago. That's playing havoc with levels of calcium carbonate, which forms the shells and skeletons of many sea creatures, and that disrupts reproduction. So for all of the people who thought, oh, the ocean's beautiful, let's go for a ride, we're flying over it, swimming in it, it's all changing. And people are not paying attention. They should. One of the important things I'm filming right now is acidification of our lakes in the United States. Found lakes in Connecticut, upstate New York, that look beautiful, highly acidic, with devastation to the fish from plants that allow the pollution to rise. They drop into these areas. You have acid rain, kills off this. I saw this when I was in West Virginia. West Virginia is an interesting state, especially where I grew up in the Ohio Valley, because you don't really see open space. Everything is up and down, up and down, up and down hills. And you have to go towards the middle of the state to see any of kind of a little bit of the open area. But every place where you see beautiful lakes, and there are many, you also see smelters and coal mines and processing. All those are dead lakes, all of them, because of acid rain. Ask the average American, what do you know about acid rain? How about nothing? You should. It's killing all our lakes. I was just down in New Orleans and filming the one of the largest dead zones in any body of water in the world. It's now as large as the state of New Jersey, right out of New Orleans, going right out in the Gulf, meaning nothing can live there because there's no oxygen because of the high acidic level. And where did that acid come from? Fertilizers. Further up, the Mississippi. This is from Fiona Harvey. This is an exclusive. Record rise despite recession means C2O target almost out of reach. Quote, this is from The Guardian. It's only two paragraphs. Greenhouse gas emissions increased by a record amount last year to the highest carbon output in history, putting hopes of holding global warming to safe levels all but out of reach, according to unpublished estimates from the Independent Energy Agency. The shock rise means the goal of preventing a temperature rise of more than 2 degrees Celsius, which scientists say is the threshold for potentially dangerous climate change, is just, quote, a nice utopia. What does this mean in lay language? It means that while all the scientists and climatologists are talking about we can't not have higher than 2 degrees increase or we'll have devastating effects, we are now having an approach of more than 2 degrees and we're having the most CO2 in world history put into the air. So not only have we done nothing about this, nothing at all, our political will among Democrats and Republicans, the corporatists, make sure that this won't happen. So, but I want you to know, people who think that we're doing something, we're not. Now to a commentary on this, which I believe is essential. The rapid and terrifying acceleration of global warming, which is disfiguring the ecosystem at a swifter pace than even the gloomiest scientists predicted a few years ago, has been confronted by the power elite with equal parts of self-delusion. There are those, many of whom hold elected office, including our president and all those who surround him, who dismiss the science and empirical evidence as false. There are others who accept the science surrounding global warming, but insist that the human species can adapt. Our only salvation, the rapid dismantling of the fossil fuel industry, is ignored by everyone. And we will be led unless we build popular resistance movements and carry out sustained acts of civil disobedience towards collective self-annihilation by dim-witted Pied Pipers and fools. Those who concede that the planet is warming but insist we can learn to live with it are perhaps, in my opinion, the most dangerous of all, more so than the buffoons who decide to shut their eyes. It is horrifying enough that the House of Representatives voted 240-184 this spring to defeat a resolution that said that, quote, climate change is occurring, is caused largely by human activities and poses significant risk for human health and welfare. But it's not much of an alternative to trust those who insist we can cope with the effects while continuing to burn fossil fuels. Horticulturalists are busy planting swamp oaks and sweet gum trees all over Chicago to prepare for weather that will soon resemble that of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where I just was. That would be fine if there was a limit to global warming in sight, but without plans to rapidly dismantle the fossil fuel industry, something no one in our corporate state is contemplating, the heat waves of Baton Rouge will be as a starting point for a descent that will ultimately make cities like Chicago unlivable. The false promise of human adaptability to global warming is peddled by the polluters' major front groups, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which informed the Environmental Protection Agency that, quote, populations can acclimatize to warmer climates via a range of behavioral and physiological and technological adaptations. My God, that is so bizarre. This utterly nonsensical theory of adaptability has been embraced by the Obama administration and our president to prepare to exploit the natural resources in the Arctic. This is Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's announcement recently that melting sea ice, quote, will result in more shipping, fishing, and tourism and the possibility to develop newly accessible oil and gas reserves. Maybe she thinks it's something worth looking forward to. I do not. Quote, it is good at least those guys are taking it seriously, far more seriously than the federal government is taking it. Who was that? That was an author and environmental activist, Bill McGibbon, who you've heard on this program many times, and the efforts in cities like Chicago to begin to adapt to warmer temperatures. Quote, at least they understand that they have some kind of problem coming at them, but they're working off the science of 5 or 6 years ago, which is still kind of official science that the international climate change negotiations are working off of. They haven't begun to internalize the idea that the science has shifted sharply. We are no longer talking about a long, slow, gradual, linear warming, but something that is coming much more quickly and violently. 7 or 8 years ago, it made sense to talk about putting permeable concretins in the streets. Now what we are coming to realize is that the most important adaptation we can do is to stop putting carbon in the atmosphere. If we don't, we're going to produce temperature rises so high there is no adapting to them, unquote. The Earth has already begun to react to our hubris. Freak weather unleashed deadly tornadoes in Joplin, Missouri, and Tuscaloosa, Alabama. It has triggered wildfires that have engulfed large tracts of California, Oklahoma, New Mexico, and Texas. It has brought severe droughts to the Southwest, parts of China, and the Amazon. It has caused massive flooding along the Mississippi, as well as in Australia, New Zealand, China, and Pakistan. It is killing off the fish stocks in the oceans and obliterating the polar ice caps. Steadily rising sea levels will eventually submerge coastal cities and islands in some countries. These disturbing weather patterns presage a world where it will be harder and harder to sustain human life. Massive human migrations, which have already begun, will create chaos and violence in India. And, in fact, India is building a 4,000-kilometer fence along its border with Bangladesh to, in part, hold back the refugees who will flee if Bangladesh is submerged. There are mounting food shortages and sharp price increases in basic staples such as wheat, as weather patterns disrupt crop production. The failed grain harvest in Russia, China, and Australia, along with the death of the winter wheat crop in Texas, have, as McGibbon pointed out, been exacerbated by the inability of Midwestern farmers to plant corn in waterlogged fields. These portents of an angry Gaia are nothing compared to what will follow if we do not swiftly act. From McGibbon, quote, "We are going to have to adopt a good deal. It is going to be a century that calls for being resilient and durable. Most of that adaptation is going to take the form of economies getting smaller and lower to the ground, local food, local energy, things like that. But that alone won't do it because the scale of change we are now talking about is so great that no one can adapt to it. Temperatures have gone up 1 degree so far, and that has been enough to melt the Arctic. If we let it go up 3 degrees or 4 degrees, the rule of thumb the agronomists go by is every degree Celsius of temperature rise represents about 10% reduction in grain yields. If we let it go up 4 degrees, we are really going to be taking our planet to a point where it will not support civilization. I have sympathy for those who are trying hard to figure out how to adapt, but they are behind the curve of science by a good deal. I have less sympathy for the companies that are brainwashing everyone along the line. Oh, we're taking small steps here and there to improve. The problem at this point is not going to be dealt with by small steps. It is going to be dealt with by getting all fossil fuel in the next 10 years, or not at all. The most appropriate thing going on in Chicago right now is that Greenpeace occupied, on Thursday at least, the coal-fired power plant in Chicago. That's been helpful. It reminded people what the real answers are. We're going to see more civil disobedience. I hope we are. I'm planning hard for some stuff this summer." Unquote. Well, the cast that we are about to see is essentially political and symbolic. There are no actual ways to shut down the fossil fuel system with our bodies. It is simply too big. It's far too integrated into everything we do. The actions have to be symbolic, and the most important part of that symbolism is to make it clear to the onlookers that those of us doing this kind of thing are not radical in any way. We are actually conservatives. The real radicals in this scenario are people who are willing to fundamentally alter the composition of the atmosphere. I can't think of a more radical, destructive thing that any human being has ever thought of doing. If it wasn't happening, it would be like a plot from a James Bond movie. The only way around this is to defeat the system, and the name of that system is fossil fuel industry, which is the most profitable industry in the world by a large margin. Fighting it is extraordinarily difficult. Maybe you can't do it. The only way to do it is to build a movement big enough to make a difference, and that is what we are trying desperately to do. McGibbons350.org is one of those. It is something we should be doing all the time. We should have been doing it over the last 20 years instead of figuring out how we can adapt. In moral terms, it is our personal responsibility, and we should be doing this all. And in conclusion, I wish there was some easy end round, some backdoor through which we could go to get done what needs to be done, but that's not going to happen. That became clear in Copenhagen last summer when the U.S. Senate refused to vote on the most mild, tepid climate legislation there could have been. We're going to have to build a movement that pushes the fossil fuel industry aside. I don't know whether that's possible. If you were to bet, you would probably lose. We've been losing for 2 decades. But you're not allowed to even make a bet. The only moral action, when the worst thing that ever happened in the world is happening, is to try and figure out how to change those odds. At least they knew they were getting into this, those who have fought in different movements. Unfortunately, we do not have those people in our movement at this time. Your thoughts, please. Thoughts from Chris Hedges, Bill McGibbon. Give us a call, 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Back in a moment, and the rest of the program is your comments. Please stay with us.
How sweet it is to be loved by you. Yes, baby. How sweet it is to be loved by you. Ooh, baby. I needed the shelter of someone's arms. And there you are. I needed someone to understand my ups and downs.
Joining in studio in New York City is Elizabeth, who reads your mail and selects those questions that are important to all of us. But on the phone from New Jersey, we have Max. Hi, Max. Max, you're on the line.
Good afternoon. I'm just calling to ask, can you recommend a good cleanser for your liver, kidney, and your intestine? And can you recommend also something like if you're on the cleansing, you won't be eating a lot of stuff. I just need something that would prevent me from getting hungry so fast.
Okay, well, the best way of preventing getting hungry is to take some ice, put it in with some lemon water, meaning squeeze the juice of a lemon, and then blend that. The lemon water just knocks out appetite immediately, and that's a good way of doing that. Otherwise, Life Extension Foundation has a list of all the best medical tests and ones that really give you the insight of what you need for your hormone balance, for your basic chemistry. You can go to lifeextension.com for that. All right, and let's see.
Okay. You said lemon water?
Yes, I did, ma'am, lemon water. Ma'am, that's to help you prevent from getting hungry, okay?
What about the cleanser?
Well, for liver cleansing, I suggest chlorophyll. Chlorophyll juices is a great cleanse, and watermelon, lemon, and lime juice together with tupelo honey is another good cleanse.
Okay, thank you.
Stefan from New York. Hi, Stefan, you're on the air.
New York. I wanted to call up about your last reading with respect to where we stand with global warming.
All right.
And I think it probably... that information is probably correct in terms of suggesting that we're past a certain tipping point. It seems to me that what would be required in terms of grassroots resistance is a much more holistic approach that combines old-fashioned, old left and the new left of the 70s in terms of its analysis of the economic issues at the root of the corporatocracy in which we live, as well as new age Gaia consciousness. And with respect to that, I think that progressives need to form intellectual alliances with the interesting phenomenon of what I would call radical libertarians. And so there needs to be a really total kind of resistance that takes on both the economic and the spiritual dysfunctionality that we are now seeing manifest itself. And as you suggest, the horrific fact of changing planetary changing planetary air, changing planetary water, changing oceans, and so on.
Okay, let me address some of your points, and thank you for sharing them. I believe that that would be a third step, more principled and more primary and more essential, is to define those areas that we need to change and how best to go about beginning the process of change. And what the opposition, both the Democrats and Republicans who are corporatized, are counting upon is that there is no third party that emerges. And clearly the Tea Party is not a party at all because it's 1,000 different fractured beliefs coming together under one umbrella and has already been usurped and manipulated. And it's become irrelevant.
Well, if I may interrupt you, I think it has been partially usurped by traditional mainstream conservative neocon Republicans. But I think that without sort of traditional progressives trying to form some kind of bridge to the underlying dissatisfaction.
Okay, but that's not addressing the larger issue. There are many people. I took the time to go to more than a dozen Tea Party rallies to speak
right.
with hundreds of individuals so I could see for myself what were they angry at, what were their solutions, and what were they willing to do as far as working with others.
Mm-hmm.
They had some very legitimate concerns.
Right.
That's why I suggest on this program, don't be attacking all Tea Party people because they're not all thinking with one thought.
I agree.
And therefore, separate out those people who have legitimate. Similarly, I believe that there are many conservative progressives who have some very good ideas, as there are some libertarians. But I've also suggested that before you get there, you're going to have to enter a time when people come together. Where if you really want spiritual people together, you have to get the Michael Lerners, you have to get the Laszlo Smidley to come in, who give a Gunga Dean from Hanover College. You have to have those individuals who have a spiritual input on a problem, who can address directly and empathetically the plight of all those who suffer. You have to have those who are good at political discourse to understand what actually causes people to vote on different referendums. And then you have to have a unity. What we're lacking now is unity. Each year at Davos, some of the biggest hypocrites on the planet get together, call themselves progressive. Not one of them is progressive, not one. I've seen the list of every single attendee. They're all corporatists. They're all oligarchs. They're all megalomaniacs. And then they come back, and they're the ones who get the media attention. What we need, and we don't have it yet, but I'm trying to do my part on working to create one place where progressives from around the world can come, either physically in person or by webinars and internet, and to hold forth on their views about, okay, let's say that you have...
Well, I think we're on the same page.
You have someone like Gerald Salante who's up in Kingston. But rare does anyone go up there, and rare does he travel out. He does his occasional newsletter. Some people read it, but that's not going to change any of the political dynamic, and it's not going to change social positions. It'll just make those people that hear him angrier, but it doesn't resolve the conflict outside of buying some gold and silver, but that's not going to be a solution.
No.
I believe that we have to take the libertarians, who I believe are the largest single group of people, even if they're not aware of it, and most of those who are more responsible in the Tea Party movement are libertarians, but then you have to cut off that part of libertarianism that is lacking in compassion and sensitivity towards the real suffering of others. That's its limitation. You have to cut off on those who are leftists the insensitivity that those who are professionals are important in understanding how systems actually work, because you can come as an ideologue or as a purist and you end up starving to death. You have to be able to take the best energy of each of the various beliefs who have stepped outside of their restricted roles and say, I'm now willing to take the next step in my own liberation, my political liberation, my intellectual liberation, by doing something. What makes a person a progressive is someone who seeks a positive solution that does not deny others, groups, or individuals to benefit from it, and therefore is it exclusively the province of one group. Then you're no different. But that'll be for another day. Thank you very much for your input. And I look at the clock, and we're out of time.
The Gary Null Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kempf. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Taubenfeld.